the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So dark.
Live from the Gateway to the West, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
And many things to talk with Charles Kalum about right now, so we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What happens when your food is irradiated? Can you taste the difference? Find out in the May issue. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Charles Kalum. Charles, let's talk a little bit about, again, the church's position on angels and demons. And how about for you, as you began to investigate, research for a lot of the things you've written, did you change at all?
Well, yes and no. No, in the sense that, you know, I've always been a Catholic. I've always believed in St. Anselm's phrase, credo et intelligam. I believe that I might understand. But it does alter your perception of things, not intellectually, but in other ways. I mean, St. John Chrysostom, another church father way back in the 400s, said that if we could see things as they really are, we would faint dead away with fright. And that's why my investigation of these things I've kept as far at second hand as I possibly can. Sometimes you don't really have a choice. But it's not something to be looked into happily. For instance, you take exorcisms. Now, I had mentioned that Father Martin, the beginning of Father Martin's transformation was because of witnessing some.
Right.
Well, I got to know our former archdiocesan exorcist here in L.A. He's now retired, and I don't know that we have one now, which may mean that Los Angeles doesn't need them anymore. I don't know. Could have become wonderful.
I don't know if that's the case.
It's possible. I'm not going to say no. But he told me some pretty hair-raising tales. He was from Sri Lanka, and he said, in my country there are many, many possessions all the time, so much demon worship. Here, very few. I only performed 8 last year. Well, of course, at this point, my heart was dropping out of my mouth. And then he described on the one case he had come in. He'd taken the black fast, which is a number of days on just bread and water. And he came in, and the little girl was spinning under the table like a top, as he put it. And he said the most embarrassing thing, and this is something I confirmed from other people and from my reading, the most embarrassing thing about an exorcism for the onlookers is that if you've got a mortal sin on you that you haven't confessed, the devil will quite gleefully call it out and tell all the onlookers what it is you did. But it doesn't matter who you are, you know, you're just dragged in off the paper or off the street to witness. But he can't do that with sins you've confessed. And that's a pattern that that gets repeated over and over and over again, both, as I say, in the literature and what I've been told. But it's not something to be played with or to be jumped into lightly.
No, not at all. I was always upset as a kid, as a Catholic kid growing up in school, why my Protestant friends never had to confess the way I had to, and they were okay. They could still go to heaven. I couldn't. Unless I did. I could never quite understand that, Charles, until I got a little older and realized, you know what? I don't think you have to go to a priest to confess. You can just confess to yourself.
Well, I wouldn't say so. You know why?
Why?
Well, if that were the case, we wouldn't need God. We just have ourselves. See, the thing is this. The priests are the successors of the apostles, you know, the apostolic succession. And they were given the commission to forgive sins, right there in the Bible. Why God would demand that we confess our sins to a man, I don't know, but I'm not God. What I do know is that it requires humility. And you see, if you look at humility, it's the opposite of what brought about Satan's fall, pride. Whenever we sin, we do so usually out of pride. The law doesn't affect me. I'm not bound by it. I can do what I want. Of course, later on, your conscience kicks in. You say, well, no, that was wrong. But to go into confession, especially to a priest you may not have a very high opinion of, it's the ultimate act in humility. And, of course, the other thing I often get from people is, well, I just repeat the same things over and over again. Why bother? To which the obvious answer is, well, why bathe? You're just going to get dirty again. Why eat? You'll just get hungry again. So, no, I wouldn't discount confession at all. I couldn't imagine living without it, to be honest with you. But I'll tell you this much. If you're going to go to an exorcism, confess everything.
Have you ever witnessed one?
No.
Is it something you don't look forward to ever doing?
That's correct. I never want to see it. I've seen people who have gone through it, and I don't want to be around for it. You know, there's bravery and there's foolhardiness. My state in life doesn't require my dealing with it, so I won't. But since you brought up Ouija boards earlier, I will tell you something rather odd. Now, Ouija boards, the church is very much against, as the church is against seances and so on. It's one thing to see a ghost accidentally, or even to go ghost hunting in a haunted house with your instruments and so forth.
Yeah.
It's another thing to try and pull the thing directly into contact with it. You don't really know what you're going to get. All right.
Very, very dangerous.
I should say. It's like living in a slum, opening up your door and saying, oh, come on in. Well, okay.
I don't lock my door. Come on in.
Yeah, exactly. Open house for all. Well, so you include me out, thanks. But when I was at New Mexico Military Institute, my first 2 years of college, there was a fellow who lived next to me, and he was a big Ouija board player. Now, then as now, I wore a scapular and a St. Benedict medal and all that. Whenever I would go into that room, it didn't work. And finally, one day, the fellow said to me, he finally put the two together, that when he and his cronies would be playing with the thing, and I'd come in, it would stop. And he said, you're wearing something. And I smiled, and I said, yep. And so I said, well, if you want to come in here when we're playing with the board, you better take it off. I said, well, then I'll just sit this one out, thanks.
What was it, a cross or something you were wearing?
No, it was a scapular and the medal of St. Benedict. The scapular is a gift of Our Lady of Mount Carmel to St. Simon Stock. Long story. Go to Google, put in brown scapular, and you'll find a ton of sites to tell you all about it.
I might have had one a long time ago.
If you were raised Catholic, I could almost promise you did.
Yep.
But you're Maronite or somewhat, right?
No, I'm straight Roman Catholic.
Wow.
I always have been.
Well, very good. But, yeah, the scapular, it's funny, thinking of the scapular, I was just talking with a ghost hunter in New England, and he always makes a point of wearing his whenever it goes into a site. And it does, you'd be surprised what a calming effect it can have on the activity.
What does this tell you? I really want to get your views on what might be out there, because we've all got our different views, Charles, on what might be in the universe, how it was created. You know, you've talked to a lot of people who have had different views on this subject.
Sure.
What do you think is there? What is doing all this?
Well, basically, I would say you have two forces in the world. You have God's will, and you have free will. That being our will and the will of the various angels, fallen and not fallen. But there are so many of these lesser free wills that it's between the conflicts among them and all that everything you see in history and life are worked out. And then through it all, you have the providence of God working as he will. For our good, if we'll go along with it, and for our ill, if we won't. The difference between ourselves and the demons is that as long as we're in the body, we can change our minds backwards and forwards, and we often do. With them, when they make a choice, because they're not, how do you say, they're not limited by their bodies, they're not pulled this way and that way by them, when they make a choice, that's it, with full malice aforethought. Well, that's why Satan, despite his intellect telling him that there's no way he can win, no way he can really unseat God, he can never cease his rebellion because he made his choice and that's that.
And he keeps trying.
And he keeps trying. And even if he can't win in toto, he can at least win over the individual soul, which is what he bends his interest to.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in response, God gave us the church and the sacraments to escape all that, to save our souls. Now, beyond that, which is to me the most basic thing, there are all sorts of other odd phenomena about that doubtless somehow fit into the picture. But because of our limitations, we can't see how. Just as we can't always see, in fact, very often we can't see at all, how God's will works, especially when something terrible happens. You know, your wife dies or you lose your job or whatever. It's, you know, why did this happen to me?
Well, do you think God has the power to stop, for example, that tsunami that killed 300,000 people in December? I don't think so.
Well, I believe he does, but you see, you've got to remember that he deals with each of us individually. Every one of those people that were killed in the tsunami, every one of those that survived it, it all had a different effect on them. The ones who died, remember, we always look at it as though we're going to live forever. The fact is, we're all on borrowed time. We're all going to die. And if we presumably survive beyond death, and thus forever, from the point of our conception on to whatever, well, to forever, the time that we're alive is very, very short. If we live to be 90, it's short. But each of those lives is a separate drama, nevertheless being worked out with all the others. So it's a huge design. And again, I'm not describing it frightfully well because no one can, but you see his will and your will. Be assured of this. You'll be taken at the very best time you can be. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that much, depending on what kind of a man you are. But you could be, if nothing else, you may be taken at the best time for everybody around you. But
if God could have stopped the tsunami, does that mean he started it?
Well, it means that he permitted it. And perhaps, did he start it? I don't know. I do know this much. That one way or the other, the tsunami came as every other disaster does come. And this is going to sound hard and strange and peculiar, but I can't help that.
Lay it out.
It came to do the best for every soul involved, even you and me sitting on the other side of the world.
Explain that a little more.
I thought that would require some explanation.
Absolutely.
Well, it's like this. An individual, again, is going to spend most of his time dead. So what's really important is how he spends it, heaven or hell. Now, the sentiments you die in are where you'll be for all eternity. Remember I said the angels can't change their views because they're pure spirits. Well, obviously, when you die, that's the spot you're in. That's why, you know, in the Hail Mary, we always say, pray for us now and at the hour of our death. That's precisely what that refers to, that we be in the right position when we die.
When we die.
Yeah. All the rest of it, all the rest of our lives, is a preparation for that moment. The many confessions you went to, the communions, the works of mercy that you're supposed to carry out, the sins you're supposed to avoid, the things you're supposed to wrestle with in your regular life, all that stuff, it's all important on its own. But it all presents where you will be at the moment you die.
All right. Are you saying, though, that these 300,000 people who died were supposed to die at that point?
That I couldn't tell you. I mean, they did die at that point. What I can tell you, because there, I mean, a lot of these sorts of things, we're limited in understanding them by the fact that we're human beings stuck in time and space. You know, our Lord says in the gospel, before Abraham was, I am. That gives you a little bit of a clue as to how things are for God. To a being beyond time and beyond space, everything must be a sort of now. And so he doesn't see these things the way we do. And because he's the, shall we say, the superior, and we're the inferiors, it's his point of view that counts in the end. It's the simile I like to use is this. Imagine you've got an ant walking across a linoleum floor, okay?
All right.
Now, that ant will perhaps, we'll pretend that the ant's intelligent. We're already stretching a little, but never mind.
You know what? Some ants may be smarter than some humans.
Well, I'm not going to argue on that one, that's for sure. But the ant's walking along, and it notices a straight line. Meaning, of course, what you would know is that the things between two, the line between two squares.
The seams, yeah.
And he keeps on walking, notices other things like that. And eventually the ant comes to the conclusion that there's something at work here. There's an intelligence behind this design. Well, you know the ant is right, but there's no way it could conceive of the kitchen, the house the kitchen is in, the people that live in the house, the people, the jobs they go to, the school they go to. There's no way the ant could figure it out because the ant is an ant. It just can't see the patterns. It can sometimes get a notion that this or that's intended, but it can't really know what the story is.
And as it crawls along, it's probably trying to figure out, what are these things?
Just so. Why is this? Why am I here? Who put me? Well, you get the idea.
Yeah.
And that, to a huge degree, is the position we're in. The medievals used to say that there were three ways of knowing reality. The first was revelation, that is, scripture and tradition, carried down from the apostles. The second, somewhat less reliable, was what they called experience, which for us would mean both personal experience, history, scientific experimentation, all those things. That was useful, but somewhat less reliable, because it comes from our limitations. And then the third and least reliable was abstraction from the first two. That is to say, trying to pull out conclusions based upon the first two kinds of knowledge. Of course, today we sort of reverse the sequence. And for us, our abstractions, our thoughts are the most important. Then comes real experience, and lastly, revelation. But at any rate, where the medievals, I think, had it over us is that they were fully aware of their limitations as men, that there were some things they were just going to have to accept because they couldn't figure them out. With us, because we've advanced so technologically,
we have to want to figure these things out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We must be able to measure it. We must know. We've got to know. Well, no, you don't. And no, you won't. That's part of what faith is all about, the willingness to accept limitations. I know that runs against the grain and so on and so forth, but it's true.
But with that, there are so many bizarre things happening, not only on this planet, but in this universe, that we may never understand.
Sure.
You know, like you were talking about Ouija boards. I believe that, too. I believe that if you play around with them, you open up a portal for these entities to come through. What I don't understand is what those entities are. Why are some of them good and some of them evil? Why does some of them want to possess people? Why does some of them want to create bad things? And I don't understand that. What makes them that way?
Well, we go back to Satan's revolt, pride. Just to think for a minute of an entity, we'll say a demon for lack of a better word, that wants to possess someone. Now, what kind of filth is that?
Exactly.
It decides that it is better, has the right to control. And so it'll do its best to do so. You know, the why is what they like to call the problem of evil. And it's actually something that affects all of us because, you know, we all do things we know we oughtn't to do. I always like to say I'm never at a loss for words in the confessional. Well, why? when you can solve it in your own heart, you'll be able to figure out the demons. I can't.
Well, I got to tell you, Charles, it is frightening, perplexing at the same time. When we come back, let's talk about some of those UFOs and also the views that you've got on werewolves and vampires and how that ties into this equation. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Streamlink now with podcasting. Get it today at coasttocoastam.com. The Gateway to the West. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Well, next hour we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with our guest. But when we come right back, let's talk about some other things like werewolves, vampires, and some even witchcraft when we come right back. Hey, Charles, I've got to ask you before we get into witchcraft and vampires and issues like that. What was it like for you to be commenting on the recent papal funeral and the conclave for the networks? Was that a pretty good experience for you?
Well, it was. It was very exciting. It certainly was cheaper than a visit there. but it was an extraordinary experience. The last one, I was sequestered in Roswell, New Mexico, and had no access to television. This time, it was fascinating to see 5 million people descending on Rome, 2 billion watching on the television worldwide. The other thing that also got me though was that a lot of the commentary really wasn't all that good. I don't mean to say my own, but you could tell that there was a real lack of
understanding. Yeah, no, that's true.
And what's interesting about that, too, you figure that Catholicism is, in numbers anyway, the largest single religion on the planet. And yet, the media classes, so to speak, know virtually nothing about it.
That's true. What was your opinion of the selection of the Pope?
Well, I was amazed. I'm happy because of the bunch. I think it was the best we could have gotten, but I didn't expect him to get it. He he's a canny old fellow. He understands the both the church and the state in the United States a lot better than most Americans do. And I think we can expect some really interesting things from him in more ways than one.
How's his health, Charles? How's his health?
Well, I don't get moment-by-moment bulletins, but I mean, he's for a 78-year-old, he's in apparently really good shape. And he's a very very humble fellow. A friend of mine who's a canon lawyer, when he was, just a few years ago, when he was still head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the second highest congregation in Rome, he ran into him on the bus, spent 20 minutes talking with him. I mean, this would be the equivalent of seeing, oh, I don't know, the Secretary of Defense on the bus in D.C.
And having him give you the time to talk with you.
Yeah, and just chatting away. And you know, you wouldn't see him there, and B, if you did, he wouldn't talk to you. So he's certainly a very, very interesting man. Well, the other thing I thought was funny was that his funeral, not his funeral, rather, but John Paul II's funeral, was almost as foreign to most American Catholics, anyway, as it was to most non-Catholics. Because, you know, we just don't have any Latin anymore. So it required a good deal of explanation, even to American Catholic audiences.
Well, I'm going to be fascinated to sit back and watch how all this unfolds and see
it'll be
if prophecy hits.
I should point out, though, for all your St. Malachi fans, that the glory of the olive, I would have thought, meant Cardinal Martini.
Because he was Roman, right?
No, because he was Cardinal Martini. Glory of the olive?
Oh. Wake me up, right?
Sometimes it isn't profound.
Sometimes you have a sense of humor.
Very often, I'm afraid.
All right. I'm with you. Witchcraft, werewolves. What does the church say about that?
Well, there again, them all. But let's take witchcraft first and get progressively wilder. The thing about witchcraft is that you'll very often hear, especially from Wiccans and folks like that, that it was a loving nature religion, a religion of the seasons that the evil church knocked down, suppressed, and then invented the image of witchcraft to justify persecuting the old religion. That's the general story. Well, the reality is that, A, the church did not invent the idea of witchcraft. And by witchcraft, let me give you a definition. It is the giving of service, as we would say in the Christian world, selling one's soul to the powers of evil in return for, well, power. It should be pointed out that the church didn't invent this idea by a long shot. Firstly, the prohibition against witchcraft is in the Old Testament. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. But it wasn't the Jews who invented the idea either. And the proof of the pudding is that in places like China and parts of Africa and so on, where the church and the Jews are nowhere to be found, people still hang and otherwise abuse folk they consider witches to this day.
I just had a story before you came on about a little girl who was going to be drowned by her supposed mother and aunt because they were convinced she was a witch.
And where were they?
Angola is where they were from, and they ended up living in England.
Well, that's a story right there. I wish I knew more. But, yeah, I mean, it's a very, there is not a culture on Earth, I don't care how primitive, that does not have a belief in witchcraft in the sense that I've given it. Now, Wicca, and I must say I know many, many Wiccans. A lot of them are a lot of fun at parties and all that.
And good people.
Yeah, but their idea of where their religion comes from is historically inaccurate. I'm not the only one who says this, I have to say. A lot of very, very well-respected Wiccan scholars are admitting this. The whole notion of Wicca that we have today really originates with a lady named Margaret Murray back in the 20s. So I like to say it's an age-old religion that goes back to the 1920s.
And they believe in a male-female god, right?
Depends on who you talk to.
All right.
A lot of them don't actually believe in literal god, a literal god and goddess. but say they're extensions of their personality or whatever. But again, this is a very ahistorical thing. You see, we always have to guard against reading back into history our own ideas. It's so easy to misinterpret symbols, ideas, and so on. I'll give you an example. If I say the eye in the pyramid, what does that say to you? The eye in the triangle, I should say.
Freemasons, the Illuminati, something like that. That, to me, that's what I think about.
Of course, that's what most of us do. Now, based on that, I could prove to you that California was a Masonic plot.
How would you do that?
Well, I would point out that if you go to several of the missions, most notably San Miguel, they've got the eye in the pyramid over the altar, and that a lot of Father Serra's chasubles, which we still have, you can see them on display in different missions here, have the eye and the triangle on the back.
Same logo.
Oh, yeah, precisely the same.
I would not have known that.
No, you wouldn't, and if you didn't know what I'm about to tell you, you would look and say, ah, Father Serra was a Mason, California's a Masonic plot, and you know, maybe that's not untrue in some way. But no, seriously, the thing that you wouldn't know is that the eye and the triangle was a perfectly respectable symbol of the Trinity before the 17th century.
Before.
And because the Freemasons picked it up, we identify it with them. They did not become influential in Spain until the 18th century. And so for Father Serra, it was just a symbol of the Trinity.
Is that much like how the Nazis destroyed the image of the swastika?
Right.
Because prior to that, it was not, the connotation of that was not evil by any means. But now you look at it, or you see it, if somebody's got it on their lapel, you look at it and go, oh my God, you want to run away from these people.
Exactly. I mean, and there are temples in India you'd feel really trapped if you went into with all the swastikas around. And by the same token, the pentagram, which we think of as a symbol of magic and all that kind of thing, has gone through several incarnations. Under the Jews, it was the seal of Solomon, with which he enslaved demons to do his will. With the Christians, it became a symbol of a number of things, but particularly the five wounds of Christ and the five joys of Our Lady, which is why, if you read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, you'll see that Sir Gawain has it put on his shield. And then, in our own day, it's been taken over as a symbol of the Wiccans, leading a lot of them to read back and say, oh, well, Sir Gawain must have been some sort of Wiccan paladin. Well, no. And the giveaway in that story is that he has the image of the Virgin painted on the inside of his shield. The other thing, of course, is that the Satanists invert the pentagram. And you know they're not inverting it to attack Wicca.
Well, that's true.
So it's the way they invert the crucifix. So, I mean, in all of these things, you've got to avoid lumping one thing in with another. If you don't, you'll make all sorts of funny mistakes. And if people know anything about it, they'll look at you sort of odd.
All right.
So anyway, we've gone off on a tangent there, but back to witchcraft. So the church, from the beginning, has always been very, very much against people giving themselves over to the devil in return for spiritual power. So the question is, though, A, is it possible to do this, i.e., can someone actually sell their soul to the devil and get power in return?
Well, you take a look at the old Dr. Faustus. He sure could, huh?
Well, again, I would say the preponderance of historical evidence would lie in favor of the belief. But because I've never actually known anyone who's done that, I can't say for sure. I do know, however, that there are a number of, at least a few, of the contracts, you might say, purported contracts between the devil and his client, in the Vatican archives. Or rather, the archives of the
world. Why would someone want to cut a deal with the devil when he might be able to cut a deal with God and get the same, I guess, benefits?
Well, because for the reason that Anton LaVey, whom you may recall, and who didn't actually believe in the devil, by the way. But nevertheless, Anton LaVey said that his God, meaning the devil, gives you stuff up front, right away. Whereas God just gives you pie in the sky by and by when you die, to quote Reverend Ike. The problem there, of course, is that by and by when you die lasts so much longer than here and now. But when people want something, they forget all about that.
And they want it right now.
They want it right now, and they forget everything else. It was Plato, I think, who said, the will precedes the intellect. You're going to go after what you want to do. It doesn't matter what you know to be true. It doesn't matter whatever you've done or promised or sworn. If you want it, you're going to do it.
Does the church believe in werewolves and vampires?
Well, now, as far as that goes, there is no. There have been theologians writing back and forth on it since the early Middle Ages. There is no defined teaching on vampires or werewolves, but there is a lot of commentary. Some of it saying they don't exist and they can't exist. Others of it saying, well, not so. They can. Because the church hasn't taken a definitive view. The individuals can think whatever they want about it. I would say, though, that it's important to remember, taking vampires first, that the vampire folklore, and it's folklore we're really looking at, is nothing like the vampire we think about, the vampire of literature, of romance, of Bram Stoker or Anne Rice. The vampire in folklore was really a possessed corpse. In other words, there wasn't a particle of intelligence, of human intelligence, left to it. It was simply a demon riding around in a dead body and keeping said shell going by drinking blood. One of the things that theologians pointed out in the Middle Ages who were writing about this stuff was that, as with anything satanic, it was a mockery of something God had done. In this case, a mockery of the resurrection. Because, of course, Christ rose from the dead. And the vampire is a sort of mockery of that. The best treatment of the vampire I've ever seen in fiction, frankly, and the most frightening, is not Stephen King, who does actually take a lot from Stoker. It's a newer writer, William Biersack, who wrote a book called The Darkness Did Not. And it has a lot of authentic vampire folklore in it, as well as a lot of Catholic stuff.
What do you think of Anne Rice's stories?
Oh, pure romances. I mean, they're not, there isn't a particle of folklore about them. I enjoyed Interview with the Vampire. For me, the Vampire Lestat sort of fell apart in the middle. And then I didn't really care for Queen of the Damned. So that's pretty much how I've gone with the Vampire Chronicles.
All right, with all of this, there is some talk, there's a camp out there that believes that UFOs are the reason why people think they've seen angels, demons, what have you. Your take on that?
Well, always with the caveat, if any of this stuff exists, because I don't know. I've seen funny lights in the sky, but they could have been swamp gas. I don't know. But all that having been said, for what I've studied about abductees and all this sort of thing, what it reminds me of are the fairies. You know, the elves, those funny folk that our ancestors believe they co-inhabited the earth with. Again, I have, incidentally, a reading list on my website, especially put together for your viewers. And I've got a number of books that go into this stuff there listed. Not by me, by the way. But one of them is by a fellow called Sinistrari, lived in the 17th century. Makes a big argument for the reality of what we would call fairies. He uses a different term. But look at what abductees are supposed to go through. This strange change in time, the odd, now you see them, now you don't-edness of their captors. The whole unreality of the thing is very, very much like the fairies. And if these beings exist, and if they do, then of course I would say they're terrestrial, not extraterrestrial. Just as to our ancestors, they appeared with castles and elven courts and so on, even as they're supposed to do today in some places. Well, what is this generation's mythology? Space. So if there's any truth to these sorts of things, and again, I don't know, but if there's any truth to it, I rather suspect that rather than being aliens from another world, they're whatever it is that have been here all along.
Are they entities or physical, in your opinion, if they've been here all along?
Well, once again, with my usual caveat, people who wrote about this sort of thing way back when maintained that they were what they called subtle matter, which is, well, sort of, it's more material than spirit, but it's less so than the bodies we have.
It's kind of right in the middle, isn't it?
Yeah, and those people, like St. Bonaventure and so on, they would hold that the soul, and really every, what we would call spirit except God himself, was made up of the same stuff. And a little bit, perhaps, of confirmation of that notion, because matter has weight and so forth, is the fact that, as you know, I'm sure, at every death, we lose a fraction of the ounce, a fraction of an ounce of weight. So perhaps that's the departure of the soul. I don't know.
Did you know that in this country, the Catholic Church owns an astronomical observatory?
Yes, they sure do in New Mexico.
Isn't that strange? Why would they do that?
Because it's the best place on Earth and most secure politically to gaze at the stars. If you look at the history of the Vatican Observatory, it started out in a tower in the Vatican itself. This was about maybe 600 years ago. The Pope at the time was, oddly enough, interested in astronomy. So he built an observatory there. But gradually, the bright lights of Rome grew up around it. They couldn't see the stars, so they moved out to Castel Gandolfo in the country, which is where the Pope has his summer villa. Well, you guessed it. The lights of Rome followed them eventually. And so about 25, 30 years ago, something like that, they made a survey, looked all over the world to find out where there was a place that had brilliant view of the sky without man-made lights, and also political stability. And the place they selected was New Mexico. I told this to some New Mexico friends, and they claimed it shows that the Vatican wasn't following state politics, but I assured them it's much more stable than most places they had to choose from.
But why would they even want an observatory, Charles? What are they going to do with it?
Well, the same reason they have an Academy of Sciences. The Vatican, the Church as a whole, has always been behind, pushed very hard for every advance in every conceivable kind of science and learning.
Interesting. Well, when we come right back, I want to get your take on whether you think they're trying to track something that might be headed this way. And then we'll open up the phone lines. It's your turn. You're next on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.